Well, good evening. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. Now, this evening we're presenting an archive show which, in many ways will dovetail and serve as a supplement to not only the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast about U.S. industrial support for Nazi Germany, but also the broadcast, the miscellaneous archive show about Japanese fascism, its history and significance for contemporary Americans. Also, some other archive shows we have, such as Radio Free America shows 1 and 2, which talk about the very significant industrial and financial connections between many of this country's top business figures and the fascist regimes of Italy, Germany, and Japan during the Second World War. This evening, we're going to be adding some very important supplemental information to our archives on some of the American and fascist industrial and financial connections. And specifically this evening, we're going to be attending to a long-neglected subject here in these archives, namely Mussolini's corporate state, the very first fascist state. Mussolini invented the term fascism. He was the world's first fascist, headed the first fascist government. And not surprisingly, Mussolini was enthusiastically supported by American industrialists and financiers, not only politically, but financially as well. Italy became basically indebted to American lending institutions. Italy, under Mussolini, survived by borrowing money abroad, kind of like contemporary America. And what we're going to be doing this evening is comparing the ills and the mythology of the corporate state under Mussolini with certain features of the corporate state that has been presented to America and the world by Ronald Reagan for 8 years and now George Bush here in the 1980s and now actually the 1990s. Now, I don't want to make it appear as though I think this is an exact analogy. I'm not at all sure there is such a thing as an exact historical analogy. Certainly, I don't think this one is exact. Nonetheless, I think it is a valid analogy, and I think it is very, very significant for our purposes here. We're going to be comparing, as I said, the corporate state under Reagan and Bush and that under Mussolini in Italy. We're going to begin by taking a look at a column this evening that by George Will, in which he describes George Bush's budgetary chicanery, George Bush's budgetary BS, I guess you could say, and some of its implications for America's future. In a nutshell, George Bush has been maintaining that, in fact, the enormous federal deficits are being reduced, and he's been doing this basically by cooking the books, by siphoning off the surplus that is coming into Social Security. He has been pretending that the books are in fact balanced in a way that they are not. He has been masking the federal deficit, and in turn he has been using this masking of the federal deficit to help justify the maintaining of the political status quo. The large military budgets, the slashing in social services that was so characteristic of the Reagan administration and which turned the United States in a few short years from being the world's biggest creditor nation to the world's biggest debtor nation, well, those policies are basically continuing extant under George Bush. And one of the ways George Bush has been able to sell this program to the American people is that he has been juggling the budget. He has been finagling with the budget, and this budgetary chicanery, this budgetary mythology, has permitted George Bush to justify the, as I say, the maintaining of the political and economic status quo at a time when maintaining the political and economic status quo would appear to hold disastrous implications for the United States. We're going to begin this evening, as I said, by taking a look at George Will's column. Under the circumstances, I think you'd have to view Will's tears over the Bush budget as either a classic case of somebody having made his bed and now having to lie in it, or perhaps under the circumstances as the ultimate example of a rat leaving a sinking ship. Of course, it was George Will who not only helped coach Ronald Reagan's debates when he was challenging Jimmy Carter for the presidency back in 1980, but it was also George Will who helped coach Ronald Reagan, who was using stolen campaign material. Specifically, stolen documents from the Carter administration were used to coach Ronald Reagan. George Will was one of the people who helped to coach Ronald Reagan prior to his debates, and then that very same George Will was relied upon as an expert network commentator on the debates, and of course he said that Ronald Reagan had done a great job and gave glowing opinions of Reagan's debate performance, Reagan's debate performance generally having been credited with much of his 1980 victory over Jimmy Carter. Of course, George Will was hardly an objective observer under the circumstances and perhaps should have been disqualified from evaluating the presidential the Reagan debate performance in as much as he was inextricably linked with having set up that very same performance. In any event, George Will is now getting religion, I guess you could say. He's beginning to see that voodoo economics, in fact, can have some very unpleasant implications when it comes home to roost. We're going to begin by taking a look at George Will and his conceptions, his evaluation of George Bush's budgetary finagling. Then we're going to take a look at the introduction from a book called The Corporate State by Benito Mussolini himself, this by way of gaining some introduction to Mussolini's corporate state and the meaning of fascism as corporatism. We're going to take a look at the corporate state under Mussolini, and specifically for the rest of the broadcast, we're going to rely on, after looking at the corporate state by Mussolini personally, we're going to rely on the landmark research of George Seldes, regarded by many as the godfather of American investigative journalists. George Seldes was one of the primary anti-fascist journalists and researchers in this country, and his work has served as a foundation for subsequent efforts by many, many political researchers. And Seldes did a tremendous amount of work on fascism, its connections to big business, and international big business in particular. We're going to begin by taking a look at exactly how fascism represented a spoils system for big business in Italy. We're going to turn to George Seldes' book, Facts and Fascism, and take a look specifically at how specific big business interests benefited from Mussolini's corporate state. We're going to take a look at some of the interests who did, and in particular, we're going to take a look at the information generated by one of the most famous anti-fascist martyrs in Italy, a fellow named Giacomo Matteotti. The assassination of Matteotti is one of the key events in the early history of Italian fascism. Matteotti was a socialist parliamentary deputy in Italy who helped expose the connections between Mussolini and big business and helped to set straight the record on as to the manner in which the corporate state actually simply served as a spoil system. Those people who backed Mussolini's march on Rome were those people who benefited from the corporate state. Matteotti, Giacomo Matteotti was his full name, helped point that out, documented it beyond the point of intelligent debate, and was kidnapped and assassinated by Mussolini's henchmen in 1924 for his trouble. We're going to take a look both at the information Matteotti talked about and some of his specific documentation, as well as touching on his kidnapping and assassination ever so briefly. Then we're going to take a look at the fond reception that Mussolini's corporate state received here in the United States. We're going to take a look at the good press that Mussolini got in the United States, and indeed the favorable portrayal of the corporate state by the American press is going to be a major focus of the broadcast this evening. In addition to taking a look at the functioning of the corporate state per se, this evening we're going to be taking a look at the interrelationship as well of the American mainstream press and American big business and how the two basically serve each other's interests. We're going to take a look at how the mainstream American press fawned on Mussolini. We're even going to review an article, or an item, I should say, from Radio Free America number 1, in which we examine how Mussolini was named an honorary member of the American Legion, at least at first. Then we're going to begin taking a look at the reasons why fascism was so well received by American industrialists and financiers. We're going to begin by taking a look at fascism as a perceived antidote to Bolshevism or socialism or communism, Marxism, whatever you want to call it. The anti-Bolshevik aspects of fascism were one of the main aspects, aside from the enormous corporate profits to be generated under fascism. The anti-communism of fascism was one of its main selling points to American big business, and we're going to talk about that next. We're going to take a look also at the tremendous financial support given Mussolini's fascist Italy by American lending institutions who floated a number of critical bond issues. Basically, Mussolini's Italy, for all of the corruption and all of the fraud, was able to at least keep its head above water for a period of time by borrowing tremendous amounts of capital abroad. Of course, this placed Mussolini's Italy in debt. It became a tremendous debtor nation, like the United States is today, and instead of sinking the borrowed capital into industrial production or into the production of consumer goods, the money was invested in heavy industry for the purposes of building a new fleet to dominate the Mediterranean, and as well as military production in general. That, of course, was not as productive an investment for the borrowed capital as it would have been had it been invested in the civilian economy, and it helped to compound the budgetary problems of Mussolini's Italy, which was a tremendous debtor nation. It basically was in hock to American lenders, much the way the United States is in hock to Japanese and German lenders. We're going to take a look at the U.S. loans to Mussolini, which ultimately helped build the Mussolini armed forces, which fought against the United States during World War II. This is a similar pattern to what we looked at in Uncle Sam and the Swastika. We're also going to take a look at one of the major points of comparison between Mussolini's Italy and the corporate state under Reagan and Bush. Specifically, we're going to take a look at the mythology of the balanced budget. The Reagan administration has been able to pull a tremendous, well, you'd have to call it a coup, a bit of verbal leisure domain in which, despite being the greatest deficit spender of all time, despite having the greatest budget deficits of all time, first Ronald Reagan and now George Bush has been able to successfully represent himself as an enemy of big government and big government spending. Well, one of the ways they've been able to do this is by playing games with regard to the budgetary deficits. Just as George Bush, as we'll see, has played games with regard to the Social Security surplus and used that to falsely portray reduced federal deficits at a time when they are not being reduced, so Mussolini's fascist Italy as well used budgetary chicanery, budgetary BS, a cooking of the books, I guess you could say, in order to continue to hoodwink American financiers to float bond issues in order to help prop up his enormously corrupt and unsuccessful corporate state. We're going to take a look at how Mussolini balanced, created the myth of the balanced budget, and how in turn the mythology of the Mussolini balanced budget, again, done simply through phony bookkeeping, through cooking the books, how the myth of the balanced budget was used to justify the continued lending on the part of American lending institutions. Ultimately, the American financiers who helped prop up Mussolini turned against him, and Mussolini in turn then blamed the failure of his corporate state on the financiers of Wall Street in the 1929 crash. That also is in some ways reminiscent of the tremendous irony of Ronald Reagan presenting himself as an enemy of big government spending, when in fact he is the biggest spender of all time. Mussolini blamed his problems on Wall Street, despite the fact that it was Wall Street that basically delayed the inevitable disaster that awaited his corrupt corporate state by financing his deficits. Basically, that they loaned him a lot of money that enabled Mussolini to make a certain amount of headway until finally he simply got so in debt and the economy became so encumbered as a result of the incompetence and corruption that not even Wall Street loans could help prop up his government. We're going to take a look at the myth of the balanced budget. And then we're going to take a look, too, at the way in which the American press, serving the interests of the American corporate interests that had propped up Mussolini, how they continued to propagate the mythology of the Mussolini balanced budget. And again, the interrelationship between those American business institutions which supported Mussolini both politically and economically, and the mainstream American press, which continued to propagate outright lies about the alleged success of the Mussolini corporate state in order to justify a continuation of the status quo vis-a-vis American lending to Mussolini and the general hoo-ha that was being generated about the corporate state. We're next going to look at some of the various other aspects of economic mythology concerning Mussolini's Italy. After a discussion of how the press continued to propagate the myth of the balanced budget, we're going to take a look at Mussolini's fallacious assertion of a better lifestyle for the average Italian as a result of his corporate state. In fact, the average Italian wage earner took a bath under Mussolini's Italy, which was overtly and explicitly anti-labor. Strikes were banned, unions were shelled, and the lifestyle of the average Italian plummeted as a result of the failure of Mussolini's corporate state. Mussolini, however, represented the opposite as being true. He trumpeted the corporate state as being tremendously successful, and we're going to take a look at again how the American mainstream press covered for the failing of the corporate state in Italy by parroting Mussolini's assertions concerning an upgrading of the Italian lifestyle, whereas in fact the reverse was the case. We're then going to take a look at perhaps one of the most basic failures of Mussolini's corporate state, perhaps the most fundamental failure, namely the fallacious assertion that Mussolini's fascism represented an antidote to Bolshevism. In fact, there had been an abortive socialist or Marxist uprising in Italy at the end of World War I, but drastically changing social and political conditions in Italy rendered the Red Menace, so to speak, invalid, even by Mussolini's own admission, long before Mussolini's March on Rome. And basically, we're going to look at a passage from Mussolini's own journalistic musings, his own writing. Mussolini was initially a journalist, that basically admits that it was not Mussolini's fascism which stemmed the tide of Bolshevism in Italy, but rather political forces which had already taken hold at that time. We're then going to look at, once again, how the American press covered for Mussolini's corporate state by continuing to propagate the myth of fascism as a successful anti-Bolshevik ploy. Even though Mussolini's fascism did not end Bolshevism in Italy, the American press continued to portray that as being the case, and we're going to take a look at that next. We're going to conclude our hard look at Mussolini's corporate state with a look at one of the least important of the many institutionalized lies concerning the corporate state, but it's one of the ones which has endured most successfully in history. One of the things one always hears about Mussolini is that he made the trains run on time. Well, we're going to take a look at just what a myth that was. In fact, the only reason the Italian trains had not been running on time was due to disruption from World War I. The liberal regime which preceded Mussolini had undertaken a successful program to rehabilitate the Italian railroads. Mussolini then took credit for that, and Mussolini made a point of keeping the high-priced express trains, which most tourists and foreign dignitaries took. He kept those running on time, to a certain extent at least, at the expense of the more inexpensively priced lines, which did not run well at all. Actually, the railroads under Mussolini experienced a slight decline. The regime responsible for repairing the disruption to the Italian rail system during World War that resulted from World War I was the liberal regime. Mussolini took credit for that, whereas in fact his brutal anti-labor policies, Mussolini had his fascisti stationed on the trains. These helped result in an actual disruption of rail service down at the everyday level. Remember, the express trains, which the tourists and journalists, foreign journalists and dignitaries took, those ran well at the expense of the rest of the Italian rail system. The myth of the Italian trains running on time will constitute the last part of our examination of the mythology of the corporate state this evening. We will conclude this evening's broadcast with a look at a haunting column which we looked at last week. It's a column from the San Jose Mercury News written by former Colorado Governor Lamb, and we're going to take a look at his own grim prognostications concerning the future of our corporate state here in the United States. That's what we have on tap for this evening. We're going to take a short musical break, and then we're going to come back with the main body of tonight's archive show. Now, we're going to begin tonight's comparison. Again, I want to stress that I'm not attempting to suggest that the comparisons between the corporate state under Reagan, Bush, and Mussolini's corporate state are anything but exact. I'm not sure, as I said, that there's any such thing as an exact historical analogy. I'm not suggesting that this one is. Nonetheless, I feel that this analogy is a valid one, and for our purposes, both significant and more than a little terrifying. We're going to begin by taking a look at one of the major ways in which, in my opinion, the pro-business administration, the corporate state, so to speak, that was introduced by Ronald Reagan in 1980 and perpetuated by George Bush so far from his election in 1988, it is similar in many ways to Mussolini's corporate state, and in one of the most ominous similarities is the use of phony bookkeeping by both the Reagan-Bush administration and Mussolini's Italy in order to make huge budget deficits appear either non-existent or less severe. And the reason for covering up the magnitude or even existence of these budgetary deficits is in order to justify a perpetuation of the economic and political status quo, even when that status quo is destructive to the country as a whole. Some comments on George Bush's budgetary chicanery, George Bush's budgetary BS, so to speak, were carried in a column by George Will. This column was run by the San Jose Mercury News on Friday, February 2nd of 1990. The Mercury headlined George Will's column, "President Chooses Not to Choose." And the column reads in part as follows. The 40th president's 10th budget went to Congress all the way from California. Reagan must have some fax bill. And the 41st president delivered the State of the Union address. The address, following the budget, further defined the Bush administration as a limousine without a transmission. Nothing connecting motor, mind, with wheels, action. Skipping down. Bush's speech in praise of good works would have been better if it had not been preceded by a budget that refutes it. Bush's budget expresses how completely comfortable he is with the straitjacket Reagan put on government with his deliberate deficits. The deficits, after all, do not inhibit the expression of impeccable sentiments. The State of the Union telecast did contain one wonderfully droll moment, doubtless lost on Bush. His entire political program is the avoidance of new taxes, which depends on squandering the Social Security surplus as fast as it flows in. So when he intoned that we must not mess around with Social Security, unquote, Republicans rose as so many sheep to bleat approval.
but also rising and slowly clapping and savoring the irony of it all was New York's Democratic Senator Moynihan. Moynihan proposes cutting Social Security taxes, thereby turning off the spigot that enables Bush to continue the presence that the government's operating deficit, the pretense that the government's operating deficit is disappearing. That last sentence again. Moynihan proposes cutting Social Security taxes, thereby turning off the spigot that enables Bush to continue the pretense that the government's operating deficit is disappearing. Bush's retort is Augustinian. Like the young and far from saintly Augustine, Bush says, "Lord, make me chaste, but not yet." Not until 1993, naturally. Bush promises he will then attack the Social Security problem with more creative bookkeeping. Moynihan has put on his party's plate an idea. His party, unused to such a rich diet, has developed heartburn. Many Democrats now mirror the mindlessness of the many conservatives who believe that any tax cut at any time for any reason is good because governmental anemia is good. And why not? Even the anemic can have impeccable sentiments. Skipping down once again. The Social Security surplus is growing $1 billion a week. In a few years, the rate will be $3 billion a week. Public employees know a bird in the hand when they see it. The birds in the bushes, alternative revenue sources, might be more equitable and economically efficient, but $1 billion a week isn't chopped liver, so why, quote, mess around with Social Security, unquote? A better question is, why not mess around with some other frauds? For 4 years, Representative Bob McEwen, an Ohio Republican, has been nudging two Republican presidents and his colleagues to pay out or cut back the highway and airport trust funds. 9 cents on every gallon of gas and 8% of every airline ticket price are dedicated taxes that can only be used for highway and airport improvements. But the monies are not being spent. They are being hoarded to mask the size of the deficit. McEwen wants the money spent for the purposes for which it has been collected, or he wants to end the lie, quote-unquote, and cut those taxes, putting the trust funds on a pay-as-you-go footing. He has asked the help of the chairman of the Water Resources, Transportation, and Infrastructure Subcommittee of the Senate Public Works and Transportation Committee. Who is? Moynihan, who says there is indeed too much money, $28 billion, sloshing around in the funds. If we start now and spend $315 billion in current dollars, we can, by the year 2000, have highways as good as they were in 1983. But bad roads suit a nation in which one political party lacks a transmission and the other a motor. Well, again, it's good to see George Will, correctly identifying the budgetary chicanery, the pretentious and fallacious bookkeeping of the Reagan and now Bush administrations as masking a very critical problem, namely the true size of the federal deficit. But again, I think this is an example of someone who really has no business complaining under the circumstances. George Will, an enthusiastic backer of the Reagan and Bush administrations, a man who helped coach Ronald Reagan for his 1980 presidential debates, whereas he then served as an expert network commentator and helped convince people that Reagan had indeed done a bang-up job. Well, that same person now is apparently turning on some of his own handiwork, namely the creation of the Reagan-Bush administration. But his words and his musings there are worth considering under the circumstances. Indeed, George Bush, in a sense, is fiddling while Rome burns. A country which is in dire economic straits does not need this sort of fantastic approach to economics. We need somebody who is willing to face the situation and deal with it in a realistic way. Fact of the matter is, though, there is a tragic and unnerving parallel between the fallacious bookkeeping of the Bush administration and the kind of fallacious bookkeeping which enabled Mussolini's Italy, the first fascist regime, the first corporate state, to pretend to be efficient. One of the major selling points, and a selling point is exactly what it was, of Mussolini's Italy, was that Mussolini had balanced the budget. And the myth of budgetary balancing has been a mainstay of the Reagan and Bush administrations. Reagan's tax cuts, supply-side economics, and so forth were supposed to balance each other. Theoretically, if taxes were cut, this would enable the wealthier interests in this country and corporations to plow the profits they got, to plow those monies back into the industrial process to make us more competitive. That obviously has not worked out. The fact of the matter is that despite representing himself as a budget cutter, as a wasteful spending cutter, George Bush, or Ronald Reagan and now George Bush, have been the greatest government spenders, the greatest deficit spenders of all time. And again, the myth of the balanced budget has been central to their operations, as it was to Mussolini's. I'm not pretending here that phony bookkeeping done by Mussolini's regime, the budgetary chicanery of Mussolini, is identical to that by Reagan-Bush, but it is similar and I think for our purposes here very significant. In a nutshell, and this is obviously something of a telescoping due to the purposes of time here, in a nutshell, fascism was a term and a political system invented by Benito Mussolini, or at least first formally stated by Benito Mussolini, the world's first fascist. Now, when journalists asked Mussolini what fascism was, Mussolini was inclined to give two one-word definitions, or two one-word synonyms. One is fascism is reaction. We're going to talk about that later. The other is fascism is corporatism. And in a nutshell, what Mussolini sought to do was to restructure the machinery of state government along the lines of the power distribution within a corporation. And again, this is an oversimplification, but when you're at work, democracy doesn't have very much to do with it. When your boss tells you to do something, you do it. I mean, in a good company, management consults with those underneath them. But the fact of the matter is, when your boss tells you to do something, you do it. You don't say, well, let's vote on it. Well, in a nutshell, that's how Mussolini sought to restructure the machinery of government along the lines of the type of distribution of power that one finds in a corporation. Now, I'm not in a position to pass judgment on that as an economic system, but certainly it is inconsistent with traditional American political values, and unfortunately, the contemporary situation in this country is beginning to resemble Mussolini's Italy in all too many ways. Now, in a nutshell, Mussolini basically sought to run Italy for the benefit of the corporations, and that was perceived, at least by Mussolini and those who supported him, as the best way for improving the standard of living of the average Italian. The fact of the matter is, Mussolini's Italy, Mussolini's corporate state, did not improve the living conditions of the average Italian. It did, however, get a lot of people rich. We're going to talk about that in a second. However, first of all, in order to understand the corporate state, let's go right to the horse's mouth, so to speak. We'll go right to the writings of Benito Mussolini, the world's first fascist, the head of the world's first fascist state, and the person who coined the term the corporate state. We're going to begin here reading from a book called, appropriately enough, The Corporate State. It was authored by Benito Mussolini, published in softcover by Valecchi Publishers, V-A-L-L-E-C-C-H-I. Valecchi Publishers published this in softcover in 1938. And of the corporate state, Il Duce, Benito Mussolini wrote as follows. This, by the way, was November 14, 1933. On the corporate state, resolution drafted by the head of the Italian government and read by him on November 13, 1933, before the assembly of the National Council of Corporations on the eve of his important speech. That last sentence once again. By the way, listeners who eventually hear this on tape should know that in February of 1990, when I'm recording this, I'm doing it with a head cold, so people will have to bear with me here if that is evident in the quality of the tape. On the corporate state, November 14, 1933, resolution drafted by the head of the Italian government and read by him on November 13, 1933, before the assembly of the National Council of Corporations on the eve of his important speech. The National Council of Corporations defines corporations as the instrument which, under the aegis of the state, carries out the complete organic and totalitarian regulation of production with a view to the expansion of the wealth, political power, and well-being of the Italian people. The National Council of Corporations declares that the number of corporations to be formed. The National Council of Corporations declares that the number of corporations to be formed for the main branches of production should, on principle, be adequate to meet the real needs of national economy. The National Council of Corporations establishes that the general staff of each corporation shall include representatives of state administration, of the fascist party, of capital, of labor, and of experts. The National Council of Corporations assigns to the corporations as their specific tasks conciliation, consultation compulsory on problems of major importance, and the promulgation through the National Council of Corporations of laws regulating the economic activities of the country. The National Council of Corporations leaves to the Grand Council of Fascism the decision on the further developments of a constitutional and political order which should result from the effective formation and practical working of the corporations. Now, I'm not going to go into any detail on it, but in a nutshell, what Mussolini meant by corporations was in many ways what we today mean by the term monopoly or trust. Basically, under the aegis of the state, each industry, each field of industrial production was to be grouped under a single state corporation. This for the betterment of the corporations, and theoretically at least the betterment through the betterment of the corporations of the lifestyle of the average Italian. That did not prove out that did not prove to be the case. But when Mussolini is talking about corporations here, he really means what we mean by trust or monopoly. Each field of industrial production was to be grouped under a single state-managed corporation, this for the benefit of the individual corporations within that given field of production. That is what Mussolini meant by corporation.
We're going to take a look now at Mussolini's corporate state, how it worked, how it was set up, who it benefited, and in particular, we're going to consider what George Seldes, one of the most important researchers on the history of fascism, what George Seldes has termed a spoil system. Although ostensibly set up to benefit corporations and make things run in a smooth corporate manner, in fact, fascism has generally turned out to be just that, a spoil system. And we're going to take a look at how that spoil system works. And specifically now, we're going to take a look at how certain big business interests in Italy backed Mussolini, and how Mussolini, in turn, used his corporate state for the betterment of those particular interests. In a sense, fascism could be thought of, instead of being government of the people, by the people, for the people, it's government of the people, by the fascists, for the corporations. Just how that worked was set forth in excellent fashion by, again, George Seldes, one of the most important researchers in one of the most important people in this field of research, and a man who was in many ways regarded as the godfather of American investigative journalism. In his landmark book, Facts and Fascism, published by In Fact Incorporated and copyright 1943, George Seldes goes into Mussolini's corporate state and who it benefited. And we're going to read now on the Mussolini corporate state from Facts and Fascism by George Seldes, again, hardcover edition, In Fact Incorporated, 1943 is the copyright date. And in a chapter entitled Big Business Bossed Mussolini, we're going to begin with our examination of some of the specifics of Mussolini's corporate state and who it benefited. Seldes writes as follows. The first modern fascist regime is the Italian. Fascism itself is as old as history, and although Mussolini is a colossal liar, he told the truth for once when he defined fascism as reaction. Who put up the money for Mussolini? Why did they invest in fascism? How were they repaid? And who footed the bill? The original fascist party of Italy, likewise the Nazi party, which was formed almost at the same time, was subsidized by a handful of the richest industrialists and landlords who wanted to preserve their wealth and power and prevent the majority of people from living a better life. The American Legion was organized for the same reason, to preserve the privileges of the few and fool the millions who believed better things would come after victory. Here is the complete list of main subsidizers of Mussolini's fascism, compiled from fascist, neutral, and anti-fascist sources, including Prezzolini, Salvemini, Bolito, and Professor Robert A. Brady and their American equivalents. By the way, interrupting the narrative here, as I proceed through George Seldes' works, not only Facts and Fascism, but Can These Things Be, and his landmark biography of Mussolini called Sawdust Caesar, some of the journalistic references and some of the references here won't be immediately clear. Most of these books are, this book was in the early 1940s. The others date from the early 1930s. So I'm not going to take the time here to explain all of these references to listeners. It would just take too much time. So I'm just going to roll through the narrative and hit the main points. Not all of this is necessarily going to be clear, in particular who many of these people are. Once again, here is the complete list of main subsidizers of Mussolini's fascism, compiled from fascist, neutral, and anti-fascist sources, including Prezzolini, Salvemini, Bolito, and Professor Robert A. Brady, and their American equivalents. 1. The Lega Industriale of Turin. The American equivalent is the Associated Industries of Cleveland, also Associated Industries of Florida, Massachusetts, Missouri, New York, and Utah. Anti-labor organizations, corruptors of the free press, employers of spies, racketeers, and murderers as strikebreakers, users of poison gas, all exposed by the La Follette Committee. The La Follette Committee, by the way, was a congressional committee that was looking into the fascistic anti-labor practices of certain major American employers. 2. The next backer of Mussolini's Italy here, of Mussolini's corporate state, I should say. The Confederazione Generale dell'Industria. The nearest equivalent is the National Association of Manufacturers, which has some 8,000 members, but which is run by a small group of men, including the DuPonts, who have subsidized the worst native fascist outfits in America. The National Association of Manufacturers works, quote, in secrecy and by deceit, unquote,
according to the final La Follette report, employs prostitute college professors, prostitute preachers, and prostitute journalists. Mussolini is the most famous prostitute journalist of our time. He sold out to the French government for 50,000 francs a month. Documentation in Sawdust Caesar. And the third of the interests behind Mussolini, the Associazione Fra Industriali Metallurgici Meccanici ed Affini. Similar to the Iron and Steel Institute, operated by our steel barons, including Weir and Girdler, one of whom employed the columnist George E. Sikulski, the other the idol of Westbrook Pegler. Fiat Automobile Works. Similar to General Motors, largest stockholder of which is the DuPonts, which is also the largest subsidizer of most native fascist organizations. 5. The Società Ansaldo, shipbuilders, Fiumi Oil Corporation, Venezia Giulia steel furnaces, the Upper Italy Hydroelectric Works, and other big outfits, equivalents in National Association of Manufacturers, leadership. The Antinazionali per la Industria Turistici and Grandi Alberghi Associations. No equivalents in the U.S., these being the Tourist Bureau and the Hotel Keepers Association, both more interested in having the trains run on time than the trainmen eating on time or at all. 7. The Landowners Association, chairmaned by Senator Titoni. U.S. equivalent, Associated Farmers. The Italian outfit consists of feudal landlords, the super wealthy of the nation, and is the cause of poverty and starvation among the farming population of Italy. The U.S. outfit includes the packers and canners who control the farm bloc in Congress, constitute the farm lobby, and are, in reality, manufacturers of food and the enemies of the homestead farmer. 8. Banca Commerciale of Milan, Banca Italiana di Scanto, and other leading banks, the equivalent of the Chase, National City, Guarantee Trust, and other banks which have spread dollar imperialism in Mexico, Cuba, and the rest of Latin America. As early as 1923, the fascist Prezzolini wrote, quote, "During the days of the coup d'etat, Mussolini's hotel was literally besieged by the most notorious speculators of northern Italy. The Confederazione Generale dell'Industria published a communique in which it claimed to have played an active part in the solution of the crisis. The Peroni brothers, formerly heads of the Ansaldo Company and of the Banca Italiana di Scanto, who had dropped out of sight after the panic of 1921, have come to life again," unquote. Italia reported November 1, 1931, that the subsidizers of fascism included the brothers Peroni, Pogliani, Borletti, Odero, and Mazzotti of Fondi Ricci and the Esatto Auto Works. Borletti, a textile manufacturer and owner of the Rinascenzi department store, also subsidized D'Annunzio in the Fiumi adventure. Concludes Italia, quote, "In 1931, among the richest men in Italy were the fascists who had had the good sense to put considerable money in foreign issues or send them abroad, notably C. Volpe, Arnaldo Mussolini, M. Ciano, Balbo, and Beneduce," unquote. Bolito reported in the Manchester Guardian and New York World in the early 1920s that when De Vecchi burned the liberal newspaper Avanti in Rome, quote, "This, for the first time, gave the fascists general press notice and attracted the attention of great capitalist bodies, the Lega Industriale, Associazione Fra Industriali, the Confederazione Generale dell'Industria. This latter body openly, the rest credibly, have continued to be the biggest subscribers to fascist funds. Those shrewd fellows of the Confederazione dell'Industria, the factory owners' organization of Milan, whose generosity is visible, though discreet, at every stage of fascism's progress through Beni and Gino Olivetti, managed to induce Mussolini and the fascist Grand Council to accept 25 million lira for the purpose of the party in its conquest of the South." Mussolini was subsidized by the Italian equivalent of our National Association of Manufacturers and similar big money outfits shortly after the seizure of the factories in 1920. In March 1919, fascist agitators caused the workers to seize the Franchi Gregorini plant. Mussolini called this, quote, "a creative strike," unquote, because the workers intended to run the plant for their own benefit. One of Mussolini's colleagues wrote, quote, "At Dalmine, he was the Lenin of Italy," unquote. At this time, Mussolini was trying to get back into the labor movement. Interrupting briefly here, Mussolini originally was a socialist, at least to hear him tell it. He basically was a prostitute. He, in essence, went to the highest bidder. He first tried to sell his totalitarian political philosophy to the labor movement, and because they were unwilling to endorse the fundamentally anti-democratic aspect of it, he wound up literally selling out to big business, whereas he had been trying to move his agenda to the labor movement only a few days before. Again, continuing here. When the factories of Milan and Turin were occupied by the workers, Mussolini held a press conference with Bruno Buazzi, who then held a place equivalent to that of Sam Gompers in our American Federation of Labor. He proposed using the money, he proposed using the factory occupation as the beginning of a military movement to seize Rome and establish a dictatorship of the proletariat. Buozzi indignantly kicked Mussolini out. Labor believed in the democratic political processes, and the main proof was that not an act of violence marked the factory seizures, although the press of the world for a month ran daily lies of bloodshed and terrorism. Within a few days, Mussolini had sold the same idea to the owners of the occupied factories, only this time the same blackshirts were to be used to create a dictatorship of big business rather than of workers. Signor Agnelli, head of Fiat, admitted to Buozzi that Mussolini actually had dealt with Olivetti of the Confederazione dell'Industria while dealing with Buozzi. This document in Chapter 8 of Sawdust Caesar. Olivetti and company put up the money. Mussolini took Rome. And in payment to the subsidizers, his first important act was the abolition of all labor unions, the equivalent of our AF of LCIO and Railroad Brotherhoods. From the day he became dictator, Mussolini began paying back the men who paid him in 1920. He abolished the tax on inheritance, for example, because it was supposed to end big fortunes, and that, of course, meant loss of money for the rich, who had in a body gone over to fascism after 1922. But Mussolini did not have the courage to abolish the political democratic system all at once, and he had many opposition parties which criticized and attacked him. His chief opponent was the socialist deputy Matteotti. The reason Matteotti had to die was because he committed the one unforgivable crime in a fascist nation. He exposed the prophets in fascism. There is no program, no policy, no ideology, and certainly no philosophy back of fascism as there is back of almost every other form of government. It is nothing but a spoil system. Well, we're going to come back and we're going to take a look at the kidnapping and assassination of Giacomo Matteotti, one of the best known, one of the most famous chapters in the history of Italian fascism. And we're also going to take a look at Matteotti's work in exposing fascism as a front for big business, as a spoil system for big business. We're going to take a musical break, then come back both with the death of and work of Italian socialist deputy Giacomo Matteotti.